So just for those who don't know anything about the Center for Economic and Policy Research, we're a nonprofit, independent organization. And we tend to be ahead of the curve. We're most famous in the United States. We were the first economists and practically the only ones to show mathematically that the stock market prices of the late 90s were not compatible with any reasonable growth projections. Therefore, it had to burst and cause a recession. And we also did a similar analysis for the housing bubble. We were the first to identify that and also project the consequences of the falling. And so this is the kind of thing, and we've done similar things on Latin America as well. We were the first to argue that Argentina would have a sustained and robust economic recovery despite doing all the things that the IMF and other and most of the media rejected in terms of economic policy. So we tend to be a little bit ahead of the curve. And so hopefully this will be true in my recommendations here. Okay, so I want to start with why, you know, some of the reasons why for this distance between the United States and Latin America. Some of them are known to all economists but are rarely discussed. That's the first one, the long-term economic failure in Latin America, and I'll show you a graph of that in a minute, but this is, Mark referred to the terrible inequality, which is about the worst in the world. That's very true, but it isn't what's changed in the last 25 years. That's been there for quite a long time. What's really changed is that economic growth has collapsed. Now, it's picked up in the last few years, but as you'll see, it's not enough to make up for it, and it probably will slow as the U.S. economy goes into recession, especially for Mexico and Central America. We just did a paper on that as well. But the main thing is this growth collapse was unprecedented. It's the worst in more than 100 years. It's not that common, really, in the history of capitalism to have such a long period really stagnant growth and a whole generation and a half losing out on a chance to raise their living standards. And this was associated, and people will argue rightly or not, with a set of Washington-backed reforms. And that's why I think that's the driving force of the elections you've had in the last decade in Bolivia, in Venezuela, in Brazil, in Ecuador, in Uruguay, in Nicaragua, in all these countries where people, you'll see, ran against neoliberalism and what they call neoliberalism in Latin America, and they won. The second thing is the Bush administration attempted to isolate Venezuela and ended up isolating Washington. We'll see what happens there. The third, of course, Mark has already mentioned the failed war on drugs, and now it's trying to morph into the war on terror with not too much success. And the so-called free trade agreements, which also have become increasingly unpopular. So let's take a look. There's the growth failure. It's pretty easy to see, even from the back of the room. From 1960 to 1980, per capita income, or per capita GDP, which is the most basic measure that economists have of economic progress, grew by 82%. This was not unsustainable. It was about half of what South Korea and Taiwan did during the same period. But the economies of Latin America went into a slump in 1980 and never really came out of it. Again, the last few years have been better, but it's only a few years, and it's still not comparable with their prior rates of growth. Look at the difference in 1980 to 2000, 9% growth total. Now you have 14% for the first 7 years of this decade. Still pretty bad overall, unless you think just the last year or so is representative of the decade. And a good chunk of that growth, by the way, is Venezuela and Argentina. Now, here are the Washington Consensus reforms. I won't go into them. Most of you probably all know them. Reduced restrictions on international trade and capital flows, financial flows, tighter fiscal monetary policies, especially high real interest rates. I would argue that that's probably the most destructive of these policies. Privatization of state-owned enterprises, labor market and public pension reforms, and the abandonment of state-directed industrial policies or development strategies, which did in the past work for quite a while. And again, not to say the same policies would work today. The world has changed. But the point being that something drastic changed. And there's almost no debate, and in official circles in Washington, there's not even a recognition that any of these policies might have been among the possible causes of this unprecedented economic growth failure. Although, as I said, all economists are well aware of what happened there. It just doesn't get a lot of discussion. And I'm not arguing that all these policies were failures, by the way. Some of them were necessary. Some of them were good. Some of them were necessary but, you know, unpleasant, depending on the circumstances when a country is living beyond its means, for example. But the overall package seems to have failed. That's what the voters concluded. That's why they went over the heads of their political leaders and voted for change, as we say in the United States. Now, this is just give you another example, because I've actually had economists try to tell me that Latin America growth slowed down because it just, you know, it reached a certain level and you don't grow as fast, like the United States doesn't grow as fast as a developing country. And by the way, I have to emphasize, everything that Marx said about the poverty and inequality is true, but the fact is, it's nearly impossible to do anything about poverty and inequality when you have very little growth, because it means that you would have to take away from others. Okay. Normally, the way you reduce poverty and inequality is when the pie expands, you can make sure that the bottom quintile gets a little more than their share, than their, you know, their proportionate share of it. And you can't do that when the pie isn't growing. And so, it is very important. I know the environmentalists often see, and I'm one myself, growth as a problem. But we're really talking about productivity growth, right? We've taken out the population growth. And so it's productivity growth that we're talking about. Now take a look at these two graphs. The this one is Brazil, and this is the Republic of Korea. And you can see Brazil grew kind of like Korea did, starting out at a higher level, actually, until 1980. And then what happened? Brazil basically, you know, stopped growing almost on a per capita level, and South Korea kept going. So South Korea has European levels of living standards today, and Brazil and Mexico would have European living standards today if they had simply continued to grow at their pre-1980 rate. So this is a drastic change. And what we're seeing now in Latin America is various governments trying to find new ways to make capitalism work. I mentioned these elections, and of course, the United States' agenda is just to push more free trade agreements. They're having less and less success with that. They can't get one. You know, Bolivia and Ecuador is out of the question. Peru, they passed with a lame duck Congress. Colombia, you know, all the civil society organizations are opposed, but and they can't get it through the U.S. Congress. So, and of course, the FTAA, which they worked on for 10 years, collapsed. So these agreements don't really have much to show for them. Mexico's growth since NAFTA has been sluggish, and there's no real success to point to. And of course, they do have devastating effects on agriculture, and they do increase the cost of medicines, and that's one of the main sources of opposition in Latin America. So this is another point that's not discussed much, but it's again well documented from the State Department's own documents. That is the United States support for the military coup in Venezuela. This really soured relations, as you can imagine. Again, in our media, and you have to always remember, when you're reading the media on Latin America and the United States, you're really reading something comparable to what you read in the run-up to the Iraq War. It's just not very good. It's not very balanced. And I know I talk to reporters every day, and so I say that to them too. And a lot of them recognize it, okay? But this is an important part of what happened. You know, when you support and actually pay people, according to our own State Department documents, to overthrow a democratically elected government, there's a backlash. And this is, you know, and then they continued to do it. They were involved in, they're still funding groups, opposition groups, not only in Venezuela, but also in Bolivia, where the U.S. State Department is funding what is often called the white separatist movement. And this provokes bad relations. And again, here our media focuses on Chavez and tries to demonize Chavez. But, you know, just last week, the president of Ecuador told President Bush to shut up and learn something about Latin America. And there have been other statements from other leaders, of course. Other presidents are much more diplomatic. But these are widely held sentiments. And we shouldn't get fooled into thinking that there's just this one bad guy. And that's you know, he's the aggressor, as he's often portrayed in the media. So this is the result. You have a deep rift between not only with Venezuela, but the rest of the region, relations are not very good. Condoleezza Rice just went down, didn't go to Argentina. There was a lot in the press how she snubbed them. They didn't really talk about that she wasn't invited. She didn't get much for her trip. As far as, she's not going to get anybody to take the position of the United States on Colombia, for example, even though, nobody but the European Union, which sadly hasn't had an independent foreign policy for the last 60-something years, nobody is taking the position that the United States is taking, that these are just terrorists and they shouldn't pursue a negotiated solution whatsoever. And this is a big difference. And, of course, Mark already mentioned the recent crisis where Colombia went into Ecuador and was, very much denounced for it throughout the region by everybody except the United States. And there are many other examples I could give of all this. Again, they're not reported all that much as they might be. I'll give you one example. Mark mentioned the Latino Barometro poll. And it's not his fault because it wasn't reported in the media, the rest of the poll. The one thing they reported was that Chavez and Bush had similar approval ratings in the region. What they didn't report was part of the poll was that Venezuela did extremely well on all the measures that when they asked people, are you satisfied with your democracy? Is your democracy working? How's your economy doing? They were one or two out of all of Latin America. And, imagine the media read this whole poll and found something rather anomalous, and they didn't report it. This happens every day. What would a new foreign policy in Latin America look like? Well, one, I would say they should give up on the NAFTA-type agreements for the reasons I described. That's that's already happening partly because there's also more and more resistance in the United States, where we've had economic growth for the last 30 years, but what we've had is probably one of the most massive redistributions of income that we've ever had, and people in general have recognized that these agreements have played a role in that. They should acknowledge that there are different paths to growth and development. Again, you don't see that yet, but it will happen. Respect for national sovereignty, very sensitive issue in Latin America, not noticed much in the United States. They normalize relations with Venezuela. I can tell you for sure that whoever the next administration is, the president of Venezuela will offer an olive branch, as he's done in the past, and we'll see what happens. Barack Obama, as Cynthia mentioned, has said he's willing to meet. But I think that there's going to be a lot of resistance from the rest of the foreign policy establishment to peaceful relations there, even though we have full diplomatic relations and free trade and everything else. You don't even need a visa to go there. I think that there's going to be real challenges there. And I should say a lot of that comes from, Florida, which we all know. I would say they should stop funding and supporting opposition groups in Bolivia and in Venezuela and wherever else we don't know about. I had one more slide here. Yes, here it is. I would say that the United States should also support a negotiated solution to the Colombian conflict. They were noticeably absent, on January 31st when the first hostage release was supposed to take place. You had the French, the Swiss, the Brazilians from high levels of government, Nestor Kirchner from Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, everybody, but the United States was showing no interest whatsoever, even in a hostage, a humanitarian exchange. This is not a good thing. I would, as Mark already demonstrated, the supply-side approach to the war, so-called war on drugs, is not working. Normalization of relations with Cuba, that's quite a ways off. I guess more modest among us would hope for easing of some travel restrictions. But again, it's pretty well recognized, if I can speak honestly here, that this is not so much a foreign policy problem as a domestic policy problem. This is the 770,000 Cuban-American voters, and those of them who support, not all of them by any means, but unfortunately the younger ones don't vote as much. This policy of hostility towards Cuba, which has gotten us nowhere for half a century. And finally, I would recommend cooperations with regional economic integration. This is happening. This is a reality. Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, all of them are very interested in regional economic integration. It hasn't been a priority at all from Washington. The Inter-American Development Bank, for example, has made about 2% of its loans for regional economic integration in recent years. So this is going to happen, and I would recommend that the United States just treat South America and Latin America as a partner, kind of like Europe. You're going to have your economic integration. That's great. Let's have commercial relations with the region, and that's perfectly compatible, instead of trying to impose the hub-and-spoke model of the NAFTA-type agreements. Okay, I think I've done my 15 minutes. I have maybe 3 minutes for questions, and then I'm going straight to the airport. Thank you. Yes?
Well, don't you also think, though, that in terms of the constraints on economic growth, that education or human capital resource constraint has also been a factor?
Yes. But again, as you can see in the graph from Brazil, I mean, they were able to overcome that. And, you know, they produced quite, I mean, they had a lot of economic development. And they're getting, you know, they're moving back in that direction now, I think, slowly. And but it's very hard. You know, macro policy really matters. When you have now that, you know, you have 11.25% interest rates at the central bank and your inflation is similar to the United States, it's very hard to have investment. It's very hard to have a home building industry. It's very hard to have the things that make the economy grow, no matter how much you put into education. It's very hard to put a lot into education when your government is under enormous pressure to cut the budget deficit, even at times when it's not necessarily appropriate, or the primary, I should say, run a primary fiscal surplus is what they've been encouraged to do for a long time. Now, they're starting to loosen up on that, and I think there's definitely a positive future there. But this is all over the region. You've had macro policies that were really incompatible with the kind of pro-development educational policies that we're talking about. Okay, go ahead.
Does your center have a website?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have announced it. All of this stuff is up at cepr.net.
And subsequently, would you extend your recommendation about regional economic integration to some possibilities of political and social integration? For example, in Central America, would make it Mesoamerica, Mexico, and other countries, and elsewhere?
Well, I think that stuff does follow. You know, Europe took 50 years to reach the kind of economic integration they have today, and especially the single currency. So these things take a long time, but I think the political and social integration follow the economic integration. It starts with trade and finance, and then it moves. Okay, one more, and then I have to go. I'm sorry. Yeah.
You mentioned the importance of growth, or you have to have a bigger pie in order to have more to distribute, or we have a distributional problem in the region, but you also have a region where class lines are among the world's most rigid. And I've always felt that, you know, even though you have all of this growth, okay, getting the distribution that we all want, social justice, if you will, is very problematic. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, well, you can see that we've just had a few years of growth, you know, 4 years, really. Again, it's not the kind of growth that you had back in the old days. And it's not clear that it's going to be sustained. So you need a sustained period of growth. I mean, that's how the handful of countries, the Asian countries that really did make it to the OECD and the rich countries' standards of living. It took a long time. It takes time, and a few years isn't really enough. But it's more difficult today. You know, we have more constraints, and we have more environmental constraints than we did in the past. But a lot of technology is not necessarily going to be environmentally destructive. So it is the key. You can't really have. I mean, you can, you know, in obviously, if you, there are societies that have redistributed income in periods of very little growth, but it tends not to be democratic societies. Okay, thank you very much. Sorry.